Atlanta's professional soccer team has come a long way fast. It took the field for the first time last year. Just last week, over 70,000 fans for Season 2's home opener. Next up for Atlanta United FC, the Vancouver Whitecaps on Saturday night. Darren Eales is the president of Atlanta United FC. Welcome back to the program, Darren Eales.
Morning, Tony. Good to be here.
Yeah, it's good to see you. Okay, so 72,000? Come on, how are you doing this?
Yeah, it's pretty incredible, isn't it? To think about it, we set the record. It's the all-time record for Major League Soccer, but we beat our previous records. We've now got the top three all-time attendances in Major League Soccer history, which is pretty crazy.
So when I ask you how are you doing this, this is a town. People who love Atlanta will admit this. This is a town that, you know, has a kind of spotty sports history, right, with fandom. But when you talk about the Hawks, it's kind of sketchy. The Thrashers are no longer here, right? They have a bit of a reputation as being fair weather fans, but you're selling tickets at a phenomenal rate, the best ever for any MLS team. Did you see this coming?
Look, I think we always thought that we were going to be successful, and by successful, perhaps 30,000 as a sort of average crowd.
Yeah.
But I think it's been interesting because when I took the job, so this was back in November 2014, really the only negative was this perception about Atlanta being a poor sports town. And I think what we thought of as a weakness has actually been our strength because, you know, Tony, if you're from Philadelphia, you're probably going to be an Eagles fan because
sure.
That's where your dad took you to see the games. But in soccer, no one's really built those allegiances up. And this city, you know, it's a phenomenal city. I think it's one of the hidden gems of America. You know, got 7 million in the metro area. People are proud to be here, but they've got their baggage of their teams from where they've come from. And I think Atlanta United has been that team that everybody can say, right, doesn't matter about the other sports in soccer. I'm an Atlanta United fan, and this is a team I can be proud of. And what's been really cool for me is now we've changed that narrative.
Yeah.
No one can say that. The other day, it was yesterday actually on CBS, they were commentating on the March Madness and the commentators were talking about Atlanta United, about a different sport, about us getting 73,000. So it's great that the city's now actually getting some recognition for being a great sports city.
So where are you drawing from principally? Is it throughout the state? Is it the Atlanta Metro?
Yeah, look, it's throughout the state and actually throughout the region. I mean, one of the advantages we've got as well was a little bit like the Braves in, you know, Ted Turner era, where
yeah.
Our nearest professional team is Orlando. So we've got, you know, not only our state at the moment, but until Nashville comes in, we've got Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina, Alabama. So people are coming from far and wide. But, you know, our core sort of fan base is that metro Atlanta area.
So your first year squad, you make it to the playoffs. Your squad loses in the knockout stage, which my son tells me is the equivalent of a wild card game in baseball. Did you expect this team to perform that well right out of the box?
No, I mean, look, I think from my background, obviously I'd been at Tottenham, I felt fairly confident on the technical side that we could put together a competitive team. But as an expansion side, it's really difficult to make the playoffs in your first year. No one had actually done it since Seattle about 10 years earlier. So we were really pleased to make the playoffs. But I'll be honest with you, I was more pleased about the fact of our style of play. So we actually scored 70 goals, which is the fifth most all-time in the history of the league. So the league's been going 22 years now. And our goal difference, that's the goals scored, take away the goals you concede, was the fourth best ever of all time. So for me, to be an expansion team that could be considered, you know, one of the top 10 teams in terms of attacking play was exciting because, you know, we're a new team. That's what it's about. It's about excitement. It's about fun. We're in the entertainment industry. So we want to be a team that not only is successful, but actually plays an exciting style of football.
So you mentioned your time at Tottenham. How would you rate the experience as director of football administration, right,
yeah.
at Tottenham? And how did that prepare you to be president, right, the next rung up of Atlanta United?
Well, at Tottenham, I was in charge on the soccer side, so it was very much soccer-focused. I wasn't across the whole business. I was a member of the board, but I wasn't specifically doing that day-to-day. So, you know, Tottenham's a fantastic club, one of the top sort of traditional clubs in England and in Europe, really. So for me, it was a great learning experience. It's a very well-run club. So we had we were very strict about the money we spent on our players' salaries. So we weren't like a Chelsea or a Manchester City that were basically being funded to spend whatever you wanted on transfer fees. So you had to be smart. You had to look for the edge. And that was really helpful for me coming to Atlanta United, because we're in a salary cap league here in Major League Soccer. So, you know, that certainly set me up on the soccer side. And then business-wise, you know, Spurs is one of the top clubs in terms of, you know, looking at the business. How do we sort of maximize that? So it was a great club for me to have been at to prepare me for Atlanta United.
So we're speaking with Darren Eales. He is the president of Atlanta United FC. Take me back to the earliest days when you knew this was happening. You're approached by Arthur Blank, and you're going to be president of this team. What was the messaging from Arthur Blank, the mission statement? What experience did you want to build for Georgia soccer fans?
I mean, it was interesting with Arthur, because you've got to give him great credit. I mean, it would have been very easy for them just to have hired someone from Major League Soccer. Major League Soccer is a very different league from the rest of the world. But Arthur always thinks big, and I think he wanted to do a sort of more of a global search and see who was out there. But when we talked, it was fairly simple. We had three really key criteria. Firstly, we wanted to have a winning team on the pitch. And that's really important, because, you know, ultimately we're in the sports industry and people want success. So we couldn't forget the fact that we needed to have a team that was going to be successful on the pitch. Secondly, we wanted to have the best fan experience. And from Arthur's perspective, you know, whether he was at Home Depot trying to build up that sort of customer base, or whether he's at the Falcons and what he's done there since he took over the club, that was a real focus. And then the third factor was to be in the heart of the community. That was really important, not only because that goes across all of Arthur's businesses and his core values, but for us as a brand new team coming into the city, it was vital that we were there front and center, trying to do all that we could to make sure that, you know, we're part of the community, not just a team playing off in an ivory tower, but actually being there and involving ourselves.
Yeah, I wonder what your goals are for this season, the reigning champion. And what I understand is possibly the greatest MLS team of all time, Toronto FC, is in your conference. What are your goals for this season? How do you step it up a level?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's interesting, because when we were coming into the league, the Eastern Conference was the weakest. And then Sod's Law, as soon as we came in, it's become by far and away the toughest conference, because there's not only Toronto, but NYCFC in New York is a really good team as well. Columbus have started really hot. I think for us, look, we expect to make the playoffs now. Now it's our second year. We want to be competing for trophies. So we would like to win the MLS Cup. We're going to give it all we can. There's also a competition called the US Open Cup, which is a cup competition that is possible, you know, trophy for us. Our aim is to be in what they call the Champions League, and that's a tournament that's within the whole CONCACAF region. So that's not only, you know, America, Mexico, the sort of Central American countries, because if you win that tournament, you ultimately play in what they call the FIFA World Club Championship. And, you know, my dream would be to get into that and play against Tottenham and beat them in the in the final. That'd be quite nice, just to
wouldn't that
stick
be great?
One over my old club. Yeah,
right.
So look, I mean, we want to be competitive on the pitch. We want to be pushing for trophies, and then off the pitch, we broke our record on the weekend. I mean, we just want to keep growing the game, keep that fan experience and that fan excitement going, and, you know, just, we don't know what our ceiling is. That's the exciting thing about it.
So, do you feel pressure to outperform last season in attendance, in performance on the pitch?
Yeah, look, I think there's pressure, but to be honest, I think it's my job, because as president of the club, we want to be a world-class club. And there's two factors to that. One, we've got to be the best within our league, but also we've got to drive the rest of the league. So I don't only see my job as, you know, trying to push Atlanta United to be as good as we can, but to push MLS to be as good as it can, because we need to grow that league. We need to grow our broadcast numbers if we're ever going to be able to compete with some of those top leagues. And so that sometimes means, you know, saying some tough things in league meetings, because we have to raise the bar of everybody so that it helps the whole sport.
We keep hearing that youth soccer is in this amazing period of growth in the United States. I wonder what your view is of youth soccer in the country. What steps you're taking to develop it in Georgia? I mean, you've got a heck of a platform right now.
Yeah, it's interesting, because what happened, obviously, America didn't qualify for the World Cup, and there was a lot of wailing and gnashing of teeth and introspection, which is good, you know, to look at those problems. But my concern is I would hate for U.S. soccer to throw the baby out with the bathwater, because I'm telling you, there's some amazing talent here in this country. And I'll use Atlanta United as an example. We set our academy up now nearly 2 years ago. We've already got a number of players that are in the American national team, under 20, under 17. There's a really great talent pool there. And obviously with our resources that we have with our training ground in Marietta, we have from under 12s up to under 19s in terms of teams and coaching facilities. But we've also got a pathway now. If you're a kid, you can see, you know, 73,000 at the Mercedes-Benz Stadium, and you've got a chance to play professionally. So, you know, there's a real talent pool here in this country. I think that the infrastructure is getting better and better. And, you know, I'd hate for people to sort of tear it all down and start again when there's some great examples of where it's working.
All right, the match this Saturday?
That's correct.
Vancouver Whitecaps. Can you take them out?
It'll be a good one for us because we got revenge. Last week we beat DC United, who had the sort of voodoo on us. We lost three times to them last season, even though they finished bottom of the table. Yes. It was just one of those things. And actually Vancouver, we played last year and lost 3-1 to them. And they match up quite well with us, so it'll be a good game for us because we know that they've got some very tall players, which is, you know, their strength, set pieces. They scored all three goals from set pieces last year. So it'll, you know, we know what we need to do, but hopefully we can get that win in front of our amazing fan base.
And a quick thought on 2026 and a possible World Cup in Atlanta?
Yeah, look, I mean, I'm really excited about this. So America, Canada and Mexico have done a joint bid. We'll find out in June. It's between those countries and Morocco. But look, there's no doubt that Atlanta is going to be one of the cities that hosts it. They just announced that yesterday that we're on the shortlist. But for us, it's how big a game can we get? This is a city that has shown it's mad for soccer, has one of the best stadiums in the world, is within 80% of the country within a two-hour flight. So, you know, I'm really hopeful that we can get one of those big games in the World Cup.
Darren Eales, he is the president of Atlanta United FC. The team faces off against the Vancouver Whitecaps tomorrow at 7:30 p.m. Darren, great to see you. Thanks for your time.
Cheers. Thanks, Tony.
Girls 8 to 18 on quad roller skates race around rinks and hone the art of jamming, blocking, and scoring. It's Flat Track Derby. On Second Thought, intern Emily Bunker visited the Atlanta Junior Roller Derby to see what this quirky sport is all about.
My real name is Tui Bratton, and my skate name is Category. There's the pack, four from each team, and those are blockers in the pack. And then there's a jammer, one from each team. And the jammers are trying to make their way through the pack legally so that you can hit and things, but there are rules. And when the jammer passes blockers, each blocker's hips they pass is a point. I started roller derby when I was 6 years old, and I am 13. Because I remember when I was little, I mean, vaguely remember, it was just really hard and I didn't know what I was doing. In roller derby, you see something and you think, that's really hard, how am I going to do that? But then you do it.
My name is Michelle Williams and I'm from Connecticut, Greenwich, Connecticut. My daughter is, she's new to rec. The very first time I was a little nervous because she was my baby and she was young. But then once I saw her and how aggressive she was, which I never saw that side of her, I was like, oh, okay, I'm fine. I say just throw yourself into it. It's awesome to watch, and it empowers females. Like, I don't know, I just sit through the whole bout, like, smiling, because I'm like, these girls are tough. They, you know, have on their makeup, they have on their cute little, you know, whatever, their skirts or shorts, but they are tough, and I love it.
This is Mattitude Adjustment, the head coach of Atlanta Junior Roller Derby. My actual name is Madeline. To see every day that there's something changing, whether they're just getting stronger themselves, or they're working better with their teammates, or they're taking a footwork thing and putting it into a practice. The leaps and bounds they've made has been amazing, and I always tell them it makes my little coach heart so happy.
My name's Alexis Robinson, but I go by Chipper, and I'm from Decatur. I got the nickname Chip in fifth grade because pretty much all I eat is chips. And when I started playing roller derby, we had to transfer that and kind of make it tough, so Chip Her holds true. My hips are apparently very bony. Girls quit sports at a young age because of social stigmas, but in roller derby, there's none of that. I mean, whoever you are, you're loved, you're accepted, and we just don't have time for hate.
I'm Violet Lorish, and I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, and my roller derby name is Violet Femmes. I'm 12. I'm on the Voodoo Dollies, and the other team is the Glitter Mafia. I wanted to play football. This was safer, probably, but you still get to legally hit people. Not in a bad way.
My name is Sean Green. I live in Midtown Atlanta. I remember when it clicked for my oldest. She's a blocker. She stopped everybody. It was incredible. My middle kid does it too, and my little six-year-old is tooling around here somewhere waiting for the opportunity to turn eight.
It's just skating and gliding on floors.
Your name's Gretchen, and your nickname's Gigi, and we've been calling you...
Gigi Normus.
It's an amazingly open and welcoming group of people. Young girls ages 8 to 18, if soccer hasn't worked, if football hasn't worked, if hockey hasn't worked, you should try roller derby anyways. It's a ton of fun.
Special thanks to On Second Thought intern Emily Bunker for producing this postcard. With no serious damage, we should add, to toes or fingers. Catch the action yourself when it's the Glitter Mafia versus the Voodoo Dollies. This weekend, visit gpbnews.org for more details. Okay, so it's been a long week. And as we do every Friday here, we've gathered a group of really smart people to kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It is time for the break room.
I made this sign with the abbreviation SOS, Save Our Students, because I really feel that this is a really big tragedy and we need to draw nationwide attention to it.
2018 is going to be crammed full of sequels, spin-offs, reboots.
Hey, Teddy, do you want an espresso before we close up?
A what?
An espresso.
And joining us in the break room are Natalie Pavelski, Vice President for Cater Communications. Samaya Khalifa is on the phone with us. She is the Executive Director of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta. Sam Burnham is the curator of the blog All the Biscuits in Georgia. I need to know more about that.
I could use a biscuit.
I have questions. And Democratic strategist Howard Franklin is with us. Welcome, everyone. Samaya, let me hear your lovely voice, please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's wonderful to be with you.
Good morning. So let's get started here with the story of star-crossed lovers Selena Gomez, Justin Bieber. Okay, bring me up to speed on this. They apparently have put their relationship on pause. It seems Selena's mom doesn't approve of Justin.
Maybe you should know that my mama don't like you and she likes everyone. And I never like to admit that I was wrong. And I've been so caught up.
So many questions, so many directions this conversation could take. Howard, let me start with you. Have you ever given a parent, how to phrase this, veto power over your dating life?
Well, I don't know if it's power that's mine to give, but
yes,
thankfully,
yes.
My parents didn't intercede too often. As I was telling some other guests this morning, I have a baby girl who's turning one this coming Monday, so I'm interested in this conversation.
Right.
For sure.
So we all can learn, right? I don't know. Samaya, what do you think?
I have a very parent-centric answer, and that is yes. And the reason for that is parents know their children probably better than the children know themselves, and they have all the experiences where they could see things the children cannot. And I believe that when somebody marries somebody, it's part of an extended family, so it needs to be up front where the parents are on board with that.
No, I get that. Sam, what are your thoughts on this?
I think that parents come into this with a lot of life experience as well. And they remember dating. They remember dating the wrong person. And if they're cringing over your choice, there may be a better reason for it than just, well, they don't want me to be dating. That being said, I think if your crazy uncle who drinks mouthwash says, hey, don't date Justin Bieber, he might be onto something.
But it feels as though it's something of a rite of passage, right? To date someone your parents don't approve of.
Yeah, the thing is, this is a bit of a boomerang relationship. They've been down this road before, but now they're in their 20s, you know? And as if your kids are, you know, my little girl is 5, so when she tells me she's engaged to Philip at her preschool, you know, I can counsel her about that. Once your kids are in their 20s, I mean, if there's something like abuse or drug use or you see something that's a huge red flag, that's one thing. But beyond that, it's really hard to get between your adult child and someone they're seriously interested in.
Not to mention they're celebrities, right? They're both wealthy. They can do what they want to do, more or less.
But what have we figured out what is the real issue in this boomerang relationship? They love each other. They love to hate each other. They always seem to come back. And even though mom may disagree, you get the sense that they will find each other again, don't you? Or is it just me?
I don't get any sense. This is completely outside of my frame of reference. I don't, you know, I didn't heard Selena Gomez or Justin Bieber's names in quite a long time. So
I'm
wholly unqualified.
Really?
Wholly unqualified to weigh in on this conversation.
I do think our world right now is a little too addicted to drama in all sorts of spheres. And that includes relationships. Yeah. I just don't think they need to be this difficult and fraught.
Yes.
And if they are, it's a red flag for me.
So I'm curious. Let's stay with this sort of dating theme here for a minute here. Have you been following what's happening with the Bachelor franchise?
No. Like, I have a life. Why would I be watching The Bachelor?
Yeah, I'm with you. We're talking about a reality television show breakup. The Bachelor's finale brought the season to a rather controversial end. The final hour featured an unedited, uncut, and I'm told a pretty uncomfortable recording of an engagement being broke off.
How do I start this conversation? The more I hung out with you, the more I felt like I was losing the possibility of maybe reconciling things with Lauren.
So what? Do you want to be back with her?
I want to see if there's that possibility.
Wow. What kind of a man brings a camera crew to breaking up with his fiancé? This is rancid junk food for the soul. This is horrible.
I agree.
Yeah, I'm with her.
What? Why, Samaya?
I agree. This is, like, really horrible in terms of bringing a camera to videotape such a breakup.
But it's part of the show. It's what you sign up for.
Yeah,
right?
I think these viewers and these wannabe television stars deserve one another. I don't think there's any... Like, I don't feel bad for anyone in this transaction.
Let's throw Selena and Justin into this show.
Right. I mean, that's part of why we watch these programs, right? For this level of drama.
But that's why I don't watch them. I mean, there's enough drama in the real world without this manufactured nonsense and faux celebrities who become... It's like this endless parade of women with the same hair extensions and one guy. It's just... It's... ugly, well, and it's
not to be sexist,
weird.
We do it the other way around too. We have a bunch of guys chasing after one girl.
Yeah. But as a matter of fact, the funny thing is, this woman who just got embarrassed on national television, guess who's the next Bachelorette?
Well, that's the rollover effect, right?
That's why I can't feel bad for her.
Yeah, she got what
she wanted. She gets a whole nother season of being on national television.
You get paid to be famous for being famous.
So have we figured out why this works, this idea, why people sign up? Maybe that's the better question. Why people sign up to have their dating lives placed on television, to be in this cattle call where you're chasing one bachelor or one bachelorette?
Tony, it beats working.
Oh, my goodness. Well, okay. All right. So let me talk to you about banning books. Maybe you followed this story a bit. An Athens bookstore was told to hide a book it displayed at a private school's book fair because it contained gay characters. Sam, let me come to you on this one. Does banning books do anything to protect students? I'm just learning that the Harry Potter series has been banned.
You can go through. There are so many books that have been banned. And I have the pleasure of being married to a school librarian, and we're talking about ethical problems in here as well. When you're dealing with a matter of a book that is age appropriate for a student, that's one thing. When you're dealing with, we're going to censor this book for content, even though the book is written for this age group, that's when you start getting into some ethical, not necessarily legal problems, but some of the best books that I have ever read have been challenged books or banned books. And once you read them, and they not only are challenged, they are challenging. They're challenging you to think and to adapt your own ideas and to not get tied into the same mindset that you've always had. Read some of these books. They're good for you.
Right. Howard, jump in.
Yeah, I think the idea of banning a book so that children aren't exposed to something in the age of the internet, it's wholly, it's useless, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're going to find all the content we don't want them to find at the tip of their fingers and on the web, on television, on radio. I just think I totally agree. Being challenged by the content of a book, I think that's a worthwhile experience. So I don't see the point in this at all.
Yeah, I think Howard's right. There's nothing in a book that kids can't find bigger, badder on the internet. It's also true that there are books I have a serious problem with, but they might not be the same books that you have a serious problem with, and that's why we have the First Amendment.
And it comes down to I'm wondering who's making these decisions.
Right. And then once a book is banned, that's when people really want it, and it improves sales. So by banning it, they're really promoting it.
Right.
Right. And Sam, what does your wife say about this process? I mean,
she goes through this a lot because you have a parent will come up and they'll say, hey, I don't think this book should be on your shelf.
How does she handle that?
Well, that's where she has to actually go back to the rules of the librarian. When you are trained, when you are in class, you know, getting your degree in library media, they teach you the ethics of that role. And you have a particular process to go in. It may be better not to buy a book to begin with if you think there's going to be a problem. But at the same time, if there's a demand for the book is age appropriate, you are actually getting into an ethical battle by banning that book and removing it from your library only by the request of a parent.
So let's learn from your wife's experience. Is this a collaborative conversation that she has? Is it her decision?
It should be. Now,
it should
not
be what?
Guaranteed. It should be her decision to be able to defend the book that's on the shelf. But when you get into a principal who's more interested in, you know, let's deal with this parent, then sometimes you may have a challenge there that you have to decide, is this, you know, is this the hill I want to die on, this particular book? But there is a struggle with school librarians nationwide over banned books. It is it's a well-known thing in that particular profession.
The most controversial book, and you can just shout them out, the most controversial book you remember reading as a child growing up, school age?
Probably The Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah. Lord of the Flies, I remember that being controversial.
But I'm a big Kurt Vonnegut fan, too, so.
right.
We can make a list of those.
Right. So, Maya, how about you?
I would say Harry Potter. It wasn't as a child, but that is a controversial book.
Okay. Let me see. Natalie, did you weigh in on this controversial
book? I'm dating myself here, but when I went to Catholic school, there was a certain Judy Blume book that was being passed around that was very controversial. The nuns found out about it and went desk to desk and removed it from everybody's desk.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris. We are having coffee and conversation, a bit of a chat and chew in the break room as we do each Friday. And my guests today are Natalie Pavelski of Cater Communications, Samaya Khalifa with the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, Sam Burnham of the All the Biscuits in Georgia blog. And I still have questions. Democratic strategist Howard Franklin. Starting this fall, Spelman College will consider any applicant who identifies as a woman, no matter what their birth gender. Samaya, let me start with you on this one. Is this problematic? I know it's potentially problematic, as are most things in the world, it seems, or a step in the right direction?
Well, I think it's a step in the right direction in terms of somebody considers themselves a certain gender, then go with that, because that's how they're acting and that's how they perceive themselves and they want to be perceived.
Yeah. Spelman College President Dr. Mary Campbell published a campus-wide letter informing the students of the policy change. There was a quote here. Here it is. The college will consider for admission women students, including students who consistently live and self-identify as a woman, regardless of their gender assignment at birth. if a woman is admitted and transitions to male while a student at Spelman, the college will permit that student to continue to matriculate at and graduate from Spelman. Does it feel like a bold step to anyone?
Yeah, it's a bold step.
Okay.
As someone who graduated from, matriculated through Morehouse College, first off, let me just say, Spelman goes to great lengths to keep men off of its campus, right? They have 6-foot-tall gate. They have a guard tower. They have officers, the whole nine yards. It's going to be...
As I look at you, handsome young man, I can understand the concept.
He knows exactly how strong the game man. Is.
4 years of trying to get onto that fortress.
So right.
Let me just say, I think just it's a terribly traditional campus, not just Spelman, but also Morehouse College, who, as you guys might remember, in 2009, I think it was, and I graduated in 2001, but in 2009, Morehouse outlawed makeup, purses, high heels, blouses, because men, young men, were cross-dressing. So I just don't think the schools are ready for this step. I applaud it from a rights perspective, but I know integrally the culture of the HBCUs there in the Atlanta University Center.
What are you really saying and not really saying it at the moment?
I just think there are a ton of – I just think – it's a very traditional campus. I just, beyond the security question, right? So
culturally conservative?
Culturally conservative too. But just think about this. As a young man walking up to a gate after a certain time of night at Spelman College, I mean, we'd be stopped, we'd be harassed, we'd be sent on our merry way. What happens when a young man shows a student ID that says he's a student at Spelman College, but he's still a young man? I just think there's going to be a lot of issues that haven't necessarily been thought through. And I don't know what the administration's plan.
Yeah. But
I think, you know, every generation's business is to shock the generations that went before. I mean, things that would have been shocking to my generation are old hat for young people now. So I don't think the students will be that upset. I think some parents might be upset. I think the process that Spelman went through was the right one. They got together alumni and students and faculty and staff, and they came up with all these rules.
Mm-hmm.
And far be it from me to tell Spelman what's right for their students.
So, you know, in reading a little bit on this subject, the pushback you hear is that inclusion is more complicated, and this is to your point, right? More complicated than simply opening up this avenue for enrollment, and that's not enough. There is this idea that in many instances, there aren't enough counselors on campus who are trained to take on these issues. There isn't enough in terms of health services support. Are you concerned that the proper groundwork hasn't been laid for a decision as potentially problematic as this?
Well, I think there's some responsibility on the applicant's part. I mean, if you're going to apply to Spelman, you know where you're applying. You know about that school.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think you need a level of support that you don't think you're going to get there, don't go to that school.
Yeah, but mind you, you're a high school student. And so
having to make this decision, yeah.
Yeah, I visited Morehouse twice on Black college tours. I had no idea what I was getting myself into, just on the lack of the administration sort of professional footing. There was no way for my 16-year-old self or 17-year-old self to understand what I was getting myself into. I'm ecstatic that I graduated from Morehouse. I'm so glad. I got 2 kids. I hope to send them each to Morehouse and Spelman when the time draws near. But I don't think a high school student or parents necessarily are prepared to consider all the – and I'm only speaking as an alum, not as someone who I think from the outside could understand all the things that are happening on those campuses.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk about the governor's race. I guess this is the final week, right, for candidates to qualify for the governor's race. We have, 7 Republicans, 2 Democrats, and 1 Libertarian who want Nathan Deal's seat. So are we impressed with the candidates? Too many choices here? What's the state of the race? Really? Crickets? I get crickets here?
Listen, Tony, let me just say, I'm also a lobbyist at the state capitol, and a handful of these candidates are still in prominent positions as lawmakers. So I got five more days of the session.
I think you're a wise man there. I mean, for my part, I'm excited that there are two strong women running for the governorship of Georgia. I think it's about darn time.
Yeah.
I look at the assortment on the other side. I mean, I'm just politically on, they're very right wing culturally. I don't think that's the direction Georgia's going. I'm not that excited about them. I do think that I do think both of the Democratic women are impressive, and I like seeing them hop in.
Okay.
I think the two women on the Democratic side is really the only remotely unpredictable thing about any of the candidates. When you look at it, they're politicians.
Right.
They're in Congress, they've been mayors or they've the lieutenant governor. What's your next logical step? Mm-hmm. I'm going to run for governor.
Same with Secretary of State.
Right,
yeah.
I've been Secretary of State. What are you going to do next? Well, I'm either going to run for lieutenant governor or governor.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we're not, you know, it's the same
guys.
Well,
I'm not feeling any energy here.
Oh, I'll be energetic for my side. I'll be energetic right. on my side of the ballot. But I can't get that all that excited about the other side of the ballot.
Samaya, what's the state of the race as you see it?
Well, I'm very concerned about what took place with Delta. If we as a state wanting to get more business in Georgia, then we need to be treating our current corporations with dignity and respect. And what happened with Delta really, I believe, gives a blow to Georgia and our chances of recruiting more companies.
And so, the Delta story is essentially Delta's position that the company took in response to the NRA's
exactly.
statements after the Parkland shooting.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
I just wanted to frame that up. All right.
Yeah. So that really is disturbing to me. And like Natalie and Sam, I'm excited about making history in Georgia and potentially having a woman governor.
Okay. I want to talk about the walkouts. High school students across America walked out of the classes. This was Wednesday morning, and they were making a statement on gun control. So. No. Go. You can play the clip. Okay, break room. Your thoughts? Let's see. Sam, let me start with you. What did you think of Wednesday's walkout, the protest by these young people? How did they handle themselves? Will it make a difference?
Well, I think we've seen, since the Parkland shooting, we've seen several students come forward. Some of them have been obviously on one side, some obviously on the other. I think we've seen some new voices, but we're still dealing with high school students. We're still dealing with...
And what does that mean?
I think that you're getting a lot of people with idealistic outlooks who, and I hate to sound cynical about this, but they haven't had the real world experience to see that there's more to it than just, oh, I've got a great idea and this is how the whole country's going to go from here on out. There's a lot more involved in it than that, and I believe that this is where you start learning that. I'm trying to remember myself as a high school student thinking, well, why don't we just do this? Well, because that's not... Why
is that you're young, you've
right.
got a lot to learn argument.
I think that's got a lot to do with it. And then you also got that same sentiment that, okay, hey, I can get out of class for 17 minutes. We got a bunch of kids that are going to get out. And, yeah, you're going to have some that have this belief that they actually want to go out there and stand for something. And then you got some people that just want to go stand outside for a few minutes.
So I'm trying to, were you supportive? Are you supportive of what the young people are doing, or attempting to do?
I'm supportive of what some of them are attempting to do. Full disclosure, I'm a full supporter of our Second Amendment and our right to bear arms. And I think that we have to find wiser ways to have a society rather than just, again, like we did with books, you can't just ban stuff. You have to learn how to properly function as a society.
Yeah.
But we're not properly functioning as a society. That's the whole point. I mean, these kids have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and they
Absolutely.
See guns as a threat. So it's, and I do think they're idealistic, but I don't know that that's a bad thing. I think we've gotten very cynical about guns in this country. I think it's become a very, you know, if you call for something that most Americans support, like universal background checks, oh, you're anti-Second Amendment. Well, no, you're not. You're saying, like any other right, including freedom mm-hmm. of speech, there are limits to it. And you know, as a former journalist, I know very well that the First Amendment sounds very absolute. You know, Congress shall not restrict freedom of speech, freedom of religion, right of the people peaceably to assemble. But there are limits on all of that. You can't just have a demonstration wherever, whenever. You can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Mm-hmm. In the same way, the Second Amendment, which in the actual text of the amendment says a well-regulated militia, regulations are not anti-constitutional. Mm. They can be part of the bigger picture.
Yeah, right. So, but it also says the right of the people to bear arms shall not be infringed.
But it says a well-regulated militia. Letting teenagers buy AR-15s is not well-regulated.
Samaya, let me hear from you on this.
Well, I think the young people are having a voice, and hopefully their voice will be carried to the decision makers and where we find a balance, where we keep those students safe. I mean, those students are worried about going to school and being killed, and this is really serious, and we need to listen to them and see what we can do as adults. I think they're acting out that way because the adults are not doing anything. And we hear about the situation in California where the teacher had a gun in class, and he ended up shooting the gun and injuring three students. So we definitely, as a country, need to sit down at the table and figure out how we're going to, you know, do the gun situation.
Yeah, Samaya, absolutely right. We don't have to go to California to find an instance of a teacher discharging a firearm. We had a teacher a couple weeks ago in North Georgia lock himself into a room, barricade into himself a room, and shoot a firearm. So, So all that to say, I totally agree. We're not keeping children safe. If children can't call for these measures, then I don't see how we go forward. And I think their inclusion and invitation into this conversation is much needed because adults have done nothing to address this issue at all.
You know, it's kind of like everybody, if you ask everybody in a room, they'll all say, oh, I'm a better than average driver. And it ain't true. Right. All of us get distracted. All of us get tickets. All of us get speeding tickets, right? Same thing with guns.
I'm a pretty good driver now.
So let me guide us into the weekend on something that's slightly lighter than this. Let's talk about Hollywood sequels. We have a trailer for Mary Poppins Returns. This is a direct sequel to Disney's original Poppins movie. Emily Blunt, Lin-Manuel Miranda will star.
Mary Poppins.
It is wonderful to see you.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
Samaya, have you had enough with sequels and prequels and reboots?
You know, I watch them, but they're never the same as the original. I mean, they're just so, there's such a big gap.
Howard, how about you?
I think
are you looking forward to Mary Poppins Returns?
My wife certainly is. I can't confess that I am, but I think it's good to give kids who, you know, otherwise would have no reason, no point of reference for a lot of these wonderful movies, a chance to see them reimagined.
Sam?
I'm going to tell you, when I saw that silhouette appear in the sky, it was Mary Poppins, I was like, oh, wow. And then it sort of hit me that when she landed, it wasn't going to be Julie Andrews. And I have to say, I'm wary. I don't know what to think about that.
Yeah.
I was set to get all grinchy about Hollywood retread and not coming up with any ideas. Then I watched that trailer. Oh, it looks adorbs. And these days, they're not making a lot of G movies. It's all PG. And I've got a 5-year-old. She's going to love this.
Let me see if I can squeeze one more quick one. Where did you go where you had the best cup of coffee you ever had in your life?
Oh, I used to visit my sister when she was in college in Montreal. And the first time on a cold day when I had one of those big bowls of cafe au lait they made up there, oh my God, it was the best thing ever.
Right. Samaya?
Every coffee shop downtown Atlanta, they serve the best coffee.
Howard?
I'm a proud member of the 1% of the 1% of American adults who don't drink coffee, who hasn't had coffee.
And proud?
Yeah, I mean, since I was
you monster!
So I can't speak to it. I like some good tea from time to time. That's about it.
I've had some good coffee. One that sticks out, I don't know necessarily was the best, Hofer's Bakery in Helen has a great cup of coffee.
And now you know. And that's our time for the break room today. Great weekend to all of you. Thanks to all of our guests, Natalie Pavelski of Cater Communications, Samaya Khalifa with the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, Sam Burnham of the All the Biscuits in Georgia blog. My questions after we're off the air. and Democratic strategist Howard Franklin. Have a great weekend, all of you. Thank you so much.
Happy Friday.
Thank you. Happy Friday, guys.
Happy Friday.